Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. It's my pleasure to be with you. We have Kirk here with us this evening. And Kirk, it's amazing that we are actually starting at the appropriate time now that the continental U.S. is in standard time. Doesn't seem to be a glitch of any kind, so that's all quite good. Three items in the news that I want to cover real quickly before we get back into our material. Okay. The first of them is that scientists worldwide, CDC included, as well as the World Health Organization, cannot figure out why there are so few deaths and so few reported cases of COVID in the African continent. I'm going to give you the most stark example, Nigeria. Nigeria has a population of 200 million. That would be essentially two-thirds the size of the United States. We're, what, 350 million? So about 60% of the United States is the total population. From the beginning of the COVID epidemic to today, in Nigeria, where only 6% of the population is vaccinated and where there have never been any lockdowns, where masks are infrequently worn, where hygiene is a problem, there have been a total of 3,000 deaths. The United States loses 3,000 people in 2 days to COVID. And the entire African continent, with the exception of the Republic of South Africa, which is, that's a house of fire. It's got every possible thing wrong, including a riotous population. But every other country on the African continent is having an exceedingly small reaction to COVID, even though hygiene is very poor, mask mandates are almost non-existent, and there have been no lockdowns. So it does tell you that the world's reaction of let's shut everybody down and control everybody, not very smart. That the idea of let's shut down business because liberals love to control it, not very smart. It tells you that the analysis we did on COVID 2 years ago, which is, yep, people are going to get sick. It's a really, really nasty virus because it combines HIV and a little Ebola, and so it's going to attack every aspect of your body. And if you're a long-haul COVID victim, it's really, really, really bad. So they really don't know what the issues are in Africa. One possibility is that malaria and the antibodies that are necessary to fight off malaria, another virus, or the drugs used for malaria, have a positive effect, because malaria is the biggest killer in Africa. And being a virus, it has a positive effect. Another is that they don't like to talk about this, but HIV in many countries in Africa is very, very high. I think like 40% of the people have HIV. And the HIV medications are also seem to be having an effect. So it could be both of those two things.
Yeah.
It could be the fact that the population of Africa is on average, I think the average mean average is 23 years old, where in Europe it's about 45. So they're half the age on average, and younger people have a tendency to fare a little better. It could be the fact that they aren't confined to close proximity indoors. There's not a lot of urban areas. People are more spread out, and they spend more of their life outdoors. And the virus does not like sunlight. And so it could be any one of those things, but nonetheless, that's it is certainly something to consider.
Yeah.
The next thing I want to talk about is a house of fire. The U.S. Has been spending money at a rate that is mind-blowing. This year, the federal budget that the Biden administration has passed for the current fiscal year, rather than being, you know, $3 trillion is kind of where we had inched up to, $3 to $2
trillion. Mm-hmm. Right.
It's now over $6 trillion. We damn near doubled the federal budget. In addition to that, we have passed legislation over the last 2 years for $6.5 trillion for COVID relief. Rather than just let business run, we devastated it, and we've weakened our currency and increased our debt over $6 trillion for COVID relief. On top of that, now, on top of this, the Biden administration now has a federal budget that's over $6 trillion. We've spent over $6 trillion on COVID relief. The first bill that that the Biden administration passed was over $1 trillion for additional COVID relief. Then he had his infrastructure bill, which was over $1 trillion, and they just passed the Build Back Better, which has, of course, nothing to do with building. It's a strictly a socialist bill that is all about rewarding failure and redistributing wealth. And that one's $2 trillion, which Congress just passed. I mean, it's like they have no concept of the value of money, or what it does when you create this kind of spending and debt. The U.S. national debt is recorded right now at $29 trillion. If you add in the unfunded mandates of the Social Security liability beyond what has been put in reserve for it, Social Security is $22 trillion in arrears in terms of an unfunded mandate. Medicare is $34 trillion in arrears in terms of an unfunded mandate. And the total U.S. unfunded liabilities of all kinds right now are $161 trillion. The U.S. annual budget, Medicaid, Medicare is $1.3 trillion a year now. Social Security is $1.1 trillion a year. The Defense Department is $717 billion, to which you have to add about $300 additional billion for spine.
Spine, yeah.
The interest on the debt, even at low interest rates, is $400 billion a year. So U.S. current spending rates right now are projected for the current year at $6,850,000,000. It's just, I mean, it's just all absolutely astonishing. And if you look at the numbers, and in 1980, the debt to GDP, gross domestic product, was 34%. Today, the federal debt to GDP is 126%.
That's unsustainable.
We're so far out of kilter. I feel like Moses. I just want to stammer.
Yeah.
Not fair to Moses, by the way. I know he claimed that he had a thick tongue, and therefore people say, well, he must have been a stutterer with a thick tongue. I don't know what the issue was. You know, I've spent the last 2 months doing nothing but translating Moshe's speeches out of Debadim. He's the most articulate man I have ever listened to. So I'll tell you what, we should all be stutterers.
Last thing
I want to talk about is Kyle. Yeah. The alleged vigilante that Rittenhouse that Biden called a right wing supremacist. I have paid no attention to his trial. It just didn't have any interest to me because here was a kid, 17 years old. He shows up at a Black Lives Matter protest where they were burning down cities in Wisconsin. And he's on video saying that, you know, he's got his medical kit. He's there to help people. And he does have an AR-15. Somebody need protection. And so he was being tried, and I said, gosh, you know, that's just not my thing. If you can't use your words, then I'm out. Okay. I'm not a guy that carries a gun off my own property to do anything but protect my own family, from imminent harm. So now I'm just not that guy. Now I understand that there's a lot of people that think that it's appropriate to be armed and to keep others from looting innocent individuals and businesses. And that's really supposed to be the government's job. But I understand the government doesn't do its job anymore, and that the liberals who control our government would seem to applaud protesters when those protesters are both violent and thieves. But anyway, that's what this kid did. So I paid no attention to it because it's just not my kind of case. There's no issues in it that resonate with me. But I figured that because it was the most watched story in the news, that I should at least look at the video evidence because I was told that there were videos shot from every which way of that day. And so you could determine whether or not this guy was guilty or innocent just by watching the videos. And so I watched them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as black and white as anything could possibly be that any rational person watching the videos sees that the first guy that was shot and killed, who, by the way, was just got out of prison for domestic violence and armed robbery, lots of various thuggery.
A lot of violent, yeah.
Oh, yeah, a lot of violent crime. That he threatened to kill Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old young man, and went after him aggressively and grabbed his gun while threatening to kill him. So, first of all, the guy's a bum. He's not black. This is not a racial incident. In fact, each of the people shot were also Caucasians. Most people don't know that, but that is the case. But the first person shot and killed was a thug, and he initiated the problem with Rittenhouse and chased after him, threatened him, and grabbed his gun before he was shot and killed. Textbook self-defense. Then there were three others. One guy that witnessed this and went up and jump kicked him. You know how you can jump up in the air and then you kick somebody. He jump kicked him in the head.
Jeez.
Yeah. And another guy took, while he was down on the ground, took his skateboard and whacked him on the side of the head with his skateboard. And then others started chasing him, threatening to kill him. And you can watch the whole video. These thugs at these Black Lives Matter rallies had no moral fiber as part of their, they are thugs. They were violent. They attacked him, and he defended himself. And it says, we can watch the video. And so you got the President of the United States calling him on a white supremacist. He's exonerated all charges, not guilty. Today, and the President says he's angry at the verdict. What a piece of crap. You have CNN correspondence that says that he was exonerated because of white privilege. No, he was being tried because he's white. He shouldn't even have been there. The judge, who was appointed by a Democrat, and therefore liberal, told the prosecution, you violated almost every part of the U.S. Constitution in your prosecution. Yelled at him. Said, beyond words, how far afield your prosecution has been and how illegal and unconstitutional it's been. But liberals don't care. Honesty, no. Integrity mean nothing. It's like the whole climate change, global warming fiasco, where a huge part of the presentation is a pile of lies. They know their lies, and they promote them thinking, well, we're justified in doing so. You can read articles that says that climate change is threatening the unborn babies of pregnant women. You know, you hear that it's about to kill off the polar bears. And yet the idiots that do the documentaries, they're fabricating everything. And they feel like they're justified in doing so. We've lost it as a country in terms of our judicial system and our personal integrity. There were liberals after liberals in the media that, in fact, one congressman that said, you know, this is just a product of white tears. He's only was exonerated because of white tears. And the protesters are threatening violence as retribution. I'm sorry. Between what we've done to ourselves economically because we are absolute dunderheads in terms of economics. One of the problems with democracy is that the people who vote have no clue as it relates to economics and shouldn't be voting. And, you know, here's the in our last election, because people didn't like Trump's personality, they voted to replace the Congress, Senate, and the White House with Democrats who have been absolutely out of touch with reality and have buried the country. So you wonder how America gets destroyed? You now know. We did it to ourselves. All right, returning to where we were. I had made some fairly bold statements, Kirk, that the entirety of Zechariah, very important prophetic book, was written for a singular purpose. There's only one theme in the book. If it's in that book, it's about one thing.
Yeah.
And that one thing is Yom Kippurim, the Day of Reconciliation, the year 6000 Yah. October 2nd, 2033, it's going to commence at 6:22 p.m. sunset in Jerusalem on that day. The entire book is written for that. So we got into the story and in Zechariah 3 about the high priest, and the high priest is called a scallywag, and his associates are called scallywags, and he says he's covered in his own excrement, filth.
Mm-hmm. Pretty foul.
And finally, he has to be cleaned of his own wrongdoing. And so, the Christians, well, this is Jesus they're talking about here. Well, if he's being cleansed of his own wrongdoing, he's got feces all over him.
Sacrificial lamb.
You got a real problem with your Jesus. And he's being lectured by a malach. No, it's all about the this Yosha was part of the group that came back from Babylonian captivity, their long time out, 70-year time out, where they came back and they rebuilt the house of Yahweh, the temple that had been destroyed by the Babylonians. And so he happened to be coterminous as the chief priest along with at the time of Zechariah. So Zechariah was shown a vision where he was a scumbag and literally a scallywag. And you say, well, so what does that have to do with the theme of this book, which is Yom Kippurim? Well, we found out. We read Kara Leviticus, the 16th chapter, which goes all the way through what Aaron, as the chief priest, upon the during the Exodus, the Yatzah, what he had to do to not only resolve his own screw-ups, like the golden calf comes to mind, and that's why it's a bull's blood to start with, and then the scapegoat, why that blood is then smeared on what? The Kapporeth. Kapporeth is based upon Kapar, which is the basis of Yom Kippurim, which is the plural of Kapar. And so the mercy seat of the covenant has the same name as the Day of Reconciliation, and it's that day, which is the only day the chief priest has said, you need to go do this on the mercy seat and sprinkle this blood on the mercy seat to reconcile the relationship between Yisrael and Yahweh. So what's the purpose of Yom Kippurim, Day of Reconciliation, to reconcile the relationship between Israel and Yahweh? And so the whole story is about how there has to be a priest, someone in the role of a priest, that can go in and sprinkle the blood of the bull and the goat on the mercy seat, the Kippurath, of the Ark of the Covenant to facilitate the Day of Reconciliation on the Day of Reconciliation, or there can be no reconciliation according to the Torah, and Yahweh is not going to violate his Torah. So it's all being set up to say, there's a way. There is a guy that we were told had blood on his hands that just happens to be available on that day. And that's what it's all pointing towards. But we'll learn more of that in a moment. So that's the story of Zechariah 3 and how it pertains to Kara Leviticus 16. Cool. I mean, it was at least, I guess you have to really get into this stuff and love it like we do to have that be something that trips your trigger, but it really did me, man. When I was, so many people have so many different agendas on who is the Yosha of Zechariah. Why is the high priest and what is said about him and why Satan is accusing him? That it was exhilarating, really, to figure out what was going on. I mean, our job, I was reading the chat room here, and one of my favorite people, Steve, who writes under BB in the chat room, was saying, good grief, you know, your current chapters are really long. I think I need a yada yada for dummies. And he's getting, he's a very smart man. But, yeah, I mean, but it's true. They are really long chapters. And the reason I brought that up is that the most recent chapters, if I encourage everybody to read the first volume of ITG, the second volume of ITG is darn near as good, is they are long chapters. And there's a lot of amazing information in them and some surprising insights and connections that we're making along the way. But our target audience, even though they have been played for fools, are still very bright people. And they're not fools. They've just been fooled. And to undo the damage that the rabbis have done to Yahweh's chosen people takes some doing. And you aren't going to fool them. You know, they know that the Christian Jesus wasn't the Messiah. And they're right. They know that the Christian Jesus was not the Son of God. And they're right. Somewhere they know that Dode was anointed the Messiah, but they don't know that he's the returning Messiah, even though the Torah and prophets, well, not the Torah, but the prophets make that crystal
clear.
Yeah. And they don't recognize him as the Son of God, even though the prophets make that perfectly clear as well.
Yeah, I called him that. Yeah.
Yeah. And they certainly do not recognize that Yosha was the Passover lamb. That's a really important role. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they've been fooled to think there was an oral Torah and that the oral Torah was also inspired by Hashem. And yet there was no such thing. And that the written Torah destroys the very religion of Judaism. These are smart people that have been played for fools, and so it is exhilarating when we learn something in studying the Torah and prophets, and this is literally bringing the Torah and prophets together. The Hebrew word for understanding, bien, is making connections between things to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the epitome of that is figuring out Zechariah based upon what we read in Kara in the middle of the Torah. And so those kind of profound insights have credibility that goes along with them that ultimately will resonate with the chosen people.
May I say that what I found, it happened to me, happened to most of the people that I've talked to in depth about how they why this grabbed them. And it's usually some trigger that grabs them. But once they get over that hump, then they will read, as we did, thousands of pages. So it's not that they're so long. They just may look a little overwhelming. But if you get into the early chapters, and I'm rereading all the first chapters and introduction to each one of these books, and each one of them are asked the question, well, we're going to cover this, da-da-da-da, and those things should grab you. If you're interested at all, and if you are, you'll just keep reading. So the length of these books would not discourage me, and
no,
it certainly wouldn't
discourage
somebody who's interested in their heritage.
Correct.
My God,
I mean, this is literally life and death. It's your soul continues or your soul ceases. This is being dragged into Sheol by rabbis lying to you or listening to Moshe and the likes of Zechariah and Yeshayah and Dod and following them into Shamayim heaven.
Yeah.
What in a world that is falling apart, in a world where the currency no longer has any value, in a world where people don't have any control over their own financial well-being, in a world where there's a pandemic that has crippled us and changed virtually
everything
worldwide.
Yeah.
in a world where anti-Semitism is on a steep incline, on a world where Russia and China are aligned together in opposition to the United States and Europe, and where the entire Middle East is ablaze, boy, you'd think that you might want to spend a little time to see if God's got an answer, because it's for damn sure men don't.
Yes.
So, one of the most challenging prophecies to interpret is found in Zechariah 4. Based upon the way it reads, it's apparent that the prophet, he didn't understand it either. And by the way, there are prophecies that the prophets don't understand. There's prophecies that the prophet gets, like Zechariah, to his credit, in witnessing the events around Yosha, the high priest, he got it immediately. I didn't get it until the fourth time I was translating it. So sometimes the prophets are way ahead of us, and they're not just reporting what they see, they understand what they see. That's like Chabaouk listening to Paul lie and deceive people. And
he
said, wait a minute, this whole thing is based upon God dying. God can't die? So sometimes they're with it, sometimes they're not. Zechariah, I don't think he understood. But in fact, I know he didn't understand, because he says he doesn't understand. Okay, so there you go. So while it's rare, sometimes God says things that are well beyond the original audience and only become meaningful to those who will be affected by them. Interesting thing. We were talking about it before the show began. There is a presentation of the knacker in Moshe's speech to the children of Israel during the midst of Devarim 29. And he's even telling Israel, says, this is going to happen during the last generation. So he set the time. He set the conditions that this is going to occur in. He says, you know, not going to happen until the last generation. And he even says that the reason this is going to happen is up to now and beyond, God has not given you the capacity to see, to understand. You aren't able to put it together, but he's going to change that, which is good news for us. So it tells us that a day is coming where God's going to pull the blinders off the eyes of his people. So Kippurim is going to be satisfactory to Yahweh because of what he's going to do to open the minds, hearts, and eyes of his people. So the reason I brought that up to you is I said, okay, I couldn't understand how in the world Solomon, who was a pretty smart dude, but how did Solomon, in the midst of the most important speech ever made, in terms of the event anyway, why did he go off and start talking about Anakri? What would he even come up with the term? Why would he make this big presentation on what this guy is going to do and you know, get it all right, by the way? Well, it's because he had not only read the Torah, he had written the Torah. It was the responsibility of every king to write a personal copy themselves so that they would know it intimately. And Moshe introduces the knacker and talks about his contribution to awaken Yisrael and bring Yisrael home in the last generation. So did Moshe's audience understand that? No.
I doubt it.
Not a chance. But,
no.
You know, 500 plus years later, Solomon did. And, you know, 3,000 years after that, we have. Took us a little time, but we got there. So we are now nearing the time of the two witnesses. So perhaps the allegorical language that is presented, because the witnesses are presented in Zechariah 4, where there's two of them, And maybe now, as we near the time that they're going to appear, the allegorical language that is used to present them will resonate with us. The Malach guiding Zechariah was not among the most direct communicators, because he wanted, and this is, by the way, common in the
teaching.
Torah and Prophets.
Yes, teaching.
He wanted Zechariah to make the connection between the things he was presenting so that he could figure out their identity and their purpose. And that's the way God communicates everything. He wants us to look at the information that he has given us, to listen to him, to closely examine and carefully consider it, so that we can be in after we yada. After we come to know it, we can make the connections to understand it. That's what he wanted Zechariah to do, and us to do as well. Moreover, the prophet was awakened from his sleep to see this particular revelation. So it's germane to say that the prophecy was after a long sleep for Yisrael.
Yeah.
All right, so here's how it begins. Then the heavenly messenger, Waha Malach, the spiritual being, returned, who had spoken to me. He roused me in a way which could be compared to an individual being awakened from his sleep. Okay, so when I first did this, in fact, until just now, I was reading that as, all right, you know, we typically don't wake up really zippy. Now, there are people that say, good God, morning. There's others, good morning, God. I'm a zippy awaker, man. When I come morning, man, I am ready to go. I'm not so good at night. But I'm pretty good in the morning.
I'll cover for you. Yeah.
So but that's not the issue here. Well, it is an excuse for Zechariah, and he's clearly stating, okay, I didn't get this. Here's my excuse. It's really about Yisrael has endured a long slumber, and they're finally being awakened. That's what this is about. So duly noted. Zechariah was not fully awake. Actually, he was awakening, which is exactly what Moshe said was going to happen. And yet, without explanation, he is shown a collection of objects. And he said to me, what do you see? You know, if a Malach is asking you questions, then he expects you to figure it out. I replied, while using the perception of sight, behold, a menorah comprised entirely of gold. It was being revealed, first and foremost, above everything else. All right. The center of the focus is the menorah. Oh, wow. I mean, that's a heck of a clue right there.
Mm-hmm.
What does the menorah represent? It represents on one side Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim. On the other side, it represents Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah.
Yes.
And in the middle, it represents Shavuah, where God's children are enriched and empowered. It represents the six steps that we walk to Yahweh. It represents the Roy G. Biv, the seven colors of the rainbow.
Rainbow. Mm-hmm.
Which is the sign of the covenant. The rainbow is the sign of the covenant because it's the fullness of light. And light is where Yahweh is taking us. He saw the one symbol that Yahweh uses to depict his plan, his people, his nature. It was a menorah. It was being revealed, first and foremost, above everything else. There were seven lamps on it. It epitomized seven, he said. Why? Because the plan is 6 plus 1 equals 7, we are nearing year 6,000 Yah. Year 6,000 Yah is 2033. It is being presented as a calendar. That what we're witnessing here is this transition between year 6,000 Yah and year 7,000 Yah, where we are empowered and enriched and can live with our God for 1,000 years. And there were 7 metal castings serving as channels and spouts on the lamps, which to show the way to the benefits of the relationship were on top of it. He's describing the menorah, which is a lamp. Zechariah 4:2. Yahweh's Rosh, foremost symbol, is his menorah. It is a light stand comprised of 6 olive lights on either side of a single lamp in the middle. God, who is light, is represented by the center luminary. The 3 spring mikre, Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, are depicted by the first 3 lamps looking from right to left, the direction of Hebrew writing. The final 3 near lamps represent the fall moed, Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah. In the center and with God, we are enriched and empowered and enlightened on Shavuah, the promise of 7. The oil in these lamps represents the Ruach Kodesh. The olive tree is deeply and firmly rooted in the land. The olive is the longest lived tree in the land. The oil of the olive is nutritious. It serves as a healing ointment. It is used for anointing, and it provides perfectly brilliant illumination. Now, just saying here, God cheats.
Mm-hmm.
He created the daggone thing, and it, you know, his metaphors walk on all fours. They are spectacular, but he did get to create them. You know, if you can create your own metaphors, you do have an advantage if you are the creator of the universe. This one is really good. Yeah, it's really, really good. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
By cheats, it's, I mean that in the kindest possible way. Key to understanding the first installment of this prophetic portrait is the recognition that Galah means to be revealed. Right? Galah means to be revealed,
yes,
to be exposed, to made known. It does not mean bowl or fountain as religious institutions would have us believe. That was the thing that got me in so much trouble. I was trying to say, what in the heck is he talking about? What in the world is the bowl? Right?
Yeah.
No, there's the it. Read the prophecy again. He asked me, what do you see? I replied, while using the perception of sight, Ra'ah, behold a menorah comprised entirely of gold. It was being revealed, Galah, first and foremost, above everything else. Ki al Rosh Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Not a bowl. It's being revealed, Galah.
Yes.
And then he went on to describe it. So the key to understanding the first installment is that Galah means to be revealed, to be exposed, to make known. It doesn't mean bowl or... There's no fountains on the menorah.
No.
Correctly translated, we are not struggling to figure out what a bowl was doing hovering above the menorah. And with Galah rendered correctly, we can focus on Yahweh's menorah, recognizing that it is first and foremost above everything else when it comes to God's symbols.
There's
it's
another
comprised,
clue.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a heck of a clue. And it's comprised of Sheba, 7 nearer small containers of olive oil. Yes, Sheba, 7. There are also 7 mutzka places for oil to flow. Beyond the seven Moed Mikrei, Yahweh spoke of his choder, the stem growing out of the rootstock of Yishai, which means to stand out and be noticed. And he revealed that the means he would use to keep him anchored, Devin Yashaya 11:1. Well, let me read that to you, because there seems to be a connection here.
Mm-hmm.
And a stem off the main branch, a choder, a sucker emerging from the root, will be extended, emerging from the rootstock of Yishai to stand out and be noticed as an observant branch, a netzar. Through the roots and that which keeps him anchored, steadfast, and nourished, such that he will continually bear an abundance of fruit, being productive while encouraging productivity in others. This is because the one spirit of Yahweh will settle and remain upon him. The spirit, too, providing the capacity to comprehend and teach. And three, the spirit to enable understanding and to make connections to reveal insights. And four, the spirit of advice and counsel. And five, the spirit of being emboldened and inspiring. And six, the spirit of knowing and knowledge, of recognizing where to look for answers to acquire information, so as to, seven, respect and revere Yahweh. That's Yeshaya, Isaiah 11:2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
as we journey through the prophecy, again, you want to understand what the prophets are saying, you have to make the connections. That's what we're doing here. That's what the Malach was asking Zechariah to do. So as we journey through the prophecy regarding the identity and purpose of the two witnesses, Yahweh will remind us that his spirit is responsible for their success. Further, Yahweh will equate them to olive trees, affirming the choder stem and the sucker metaphor. It is also instructive to know that in addition to the seven Moed Mikrei and the seven benefits associated with Yahweh's spirit, there are seven colors in the rainbow. And of course, this is relevant because the rainbow is the symbol of the covenant. These colors are red, orange, and yellow on top, green symbolic of growth in the middle, and blue, indigo, and violet beneath. The menorah is Yahweh's witness. From it, we can deduce insights into his nature and plan, and that is why the two witnesses represented by the olive trees are stationed on either side of Yahweh's symbolic luminary. That's what they're focused on. The story of the menorah begins with the tree which enables it to shine, illuminating our lives, the olive. It is symbolic of Yahweh's people in conjunction with his spirit. And as shared a moment ago, the olive is native to the land. It is firmly rooted and able to survive even the most severe storms. It is particularly long-lived. Its fruit must be crushed before it's productive. And olive oil remains a source of brilliant light, healing ointment, and nourishment. The perfect way to convey many of the meaningful things that are relevant to God. Before we turn to Zechariah 4:3, is there anything in there that your artistry found as you analyzed the words or the letters?
Well, you might want to wait to the end because there's so many words in there that and I'll just build my case on at the end. I'll just show you what they all are.
All right.
And it's kind of overwhelming.
I'll
don't
do
want to
that,
break the flow.
Okay, we'll do that.
And then we can talk about it later.
Yeah, because this is really, I mean, I'm rubbing my hands together. This is really interesting stuff. Okay.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
There were two, this is, now we're turning to the text itself. There were two olive trees by it, by the menorah. One on the right of the revelation, the Galah, and the other one on its left. Now remember, we always read in Hebrew from right to left. Everything goes from right to left.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there will be two witnesses. The one on the right was identified in the final line of what may have been the last prophet. In Malachi, Malachi 4, 4 through 6, we discovered that he is Elijah. These could well be Yahweh's last words to his people. I'm going to read the conclusion of Malachi 4:4. Remember, Zachar, the Torah teaching and guidance of my associate, Moshe, which, to show the way to the benefits of the relationship, I provided as instructions through him in Toreb for all Yisrael, including the prescriptions for living that cut you into the relationship and the means to exercise good judgment, particularly regarding the way to resolve disputes. Behold, I myself will send to you Elijah, the prophet, before the coming arrival of this exceedingly important and awesomely inspiring day of Yahweh. Then he will restore the thinking and the inclinations of the fathers for the children, and the thinking and inclinations of the children to their fathers, or otherwise I will arrive and inflict the land, because it is so disfigured, it appears like the sea, which is a metaphor for Gentiles. And by the way, in the Torah, when Yahweh says, you know, I'm not going to facilitate your inclination to think about this, to make good decisions about it, it's written exactly the same way as it is here. Elijah is an interesting choice. He did not provide even a tenth of the prophecies of Moshe, of Dod, of Samuel, of Yirmiyah, or Yashayah. But he had something we do not see in other prophets. Elijah was sarcastic. He was quick-witted and exceedingly judgmental. He knew how to play that crowd on Yahweh's behalf. He was always ready and willing to trash the reputations of the religious and political. We don't see that in other prophets. We don't see them in a debate. We don't see them interacting where somebody is throwing stuff at them and is accusing them, is attacking them, and is criticizing them, and to see how he can immediately twist it such that God's message resonates and the people that are criticizing him are torn to ribbons by a quick-witted and well-chosen and timely response. Clearly, Dod was more articulate, as was Moshe, as even was Yashayah and Yirmiyah. But no one had what Elijah had. Biting, quick-witted, exceedingly judgmental sarcasm. Therefore, and God, by the way, God must love it.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, we can deduce a couple of things. First, God recognizes the merit in mocking a society's leadership, openly and bluntly exposing and condemning them. And second, he is fond of a witness who is not afraid to stand up against the rich and powerful. Those that have read the last two volumes that I've written, and it's also one that I'm in the midst of, is not published yet. But if you have read the Moed volume, or even the Harvest volume, followed by the Appointment volume of Yad Yah 5 and 6, and if you've read the Introduction to God, you know that I am not kind to rabbis, and I am exceedingly sarcastic, biting. The tone is unlike anything that we had ever dealt with before, mocking them. And so it's clear that this has Yahweh's hand all over it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the biggest change, I would say, in the rewrite, is the attention's focused on rabbis, and it's very, very similar to the tone that Eliyahu takes with the religious and political establishment of his day. So with Eliyahu being chosen to witness to Yisrael in the years before Yahweh's arrival, his partner will likely share many of the same traits, albeit more in tune with the challenging false notions of Christians, Muslims, and progressive multiculturalists, which were not around in Eliyahu's day.
No.
There isn't much difference in the religions that Eliyahu was denouncing and the religion of Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
He understands his people will have no problem with the political and religious elite.
Okay.
But he knows nothing of Christianity, nothing of Islam, nothing of progressive multiculturalists. And Yahweh likes to use people who have a working knowledge of what he despises. Let me give you the best example in the world. Moshe. The reason Moshe was chosen and why no one else could fill that role is because Moshe had walked away from having spent a lifetime right in the heart of the beast. He understood it. And so in the second witness, based upon God acknowledging that Eliyahu will be one of the two, and the one thing that distinguishes Eliyahu is this quick-witted, exceedingly biting, judgmental rhetoric. The only difference is that there are more foes now than Jews. Now, since the choder is a sucker growing out of the rootstock, every time I say sucker, I smile because I happen to like the self-effacing nature of that term. Sucker is a pejorative in the English language.
Yes.
Sucker is not a pejorative, and for anyone that understands the nature of an olive tree. A sucker on an olive tree shows that an old stump, an old stump rooted in the ground that's been cut down. There is no life at all that anyone has noticed in this old tree, but a sucker can come up right from the rootstock. And that sucker, unlike a sucker on most any other tree, can be exceedingly productive, bringing that stump back to life. So if you understand the olive, which is God's metaphor here, choder's a really good thing, but in English it's a pejorative, so it's God being sarcastic probably, because it's kind of fun. But nonetheless, the choder is a sucker, growing out of the rootstock of an old olive tree, giving it new life. Perhaps he is the other witness, standing on either side of the menorah. The two olive trees will be discussing Yahweh's symbols and using them to reveal his Torah. So Zechariah 4:4. So then I responded by saying to the spiritual messenger, the Malach, who had spoken to me, why are these here, sir? Not the answer the Moloch wanted to hear. Didn't want to hear a question. He wanted to hear an answer.
Yeah.
You know, Zachariah had already impressed the living tar out of him with the, well, let me bring in the headscarf as it relates to the high priest. Mm-hmm. So Zachariah was on his game. God does not use dumb people. Zachariah was smart. He knew his Torah. And so the messenger thought, you know, you should be able to figure this out, pal. And the heavenly representative who had spoken with me answered, and he said to me, why don't you know Yada or understand what these represent?
Profound.
I said, I don't, sir. So it is, this is a case where he just did not understand. And I'm telling you that I've been doing this now 21 years. Five times I went through it, I wouldn't even publish my translation of them because I didn't understand it. So this is the very first time that I've shared a translation of this because, and I even said to Yah on this, I said, okay. I know that to present Kippurim, that I've got to translate Zachariah. And it appears to me that I've got to go right from the beginning and work through the prophet to do your day justice. But if I'm going to do that, up to this point, I have not understood Zachariah 3 with who in the heck is Yoseh in this case. And that presentation of the two witnesses, I'm right with Zachariah. I ain't got a clue. So if we're going to do this, I'm going to need some help. So I said, I do not know, sir. Then he answered and said to me, this is the word of Yahweh to Zerubbabel, the nauseating seed of the Lord of Confusion sown by Babylon's commingling. Think of that. This is the word of Yahweh to the nauseating seed of the Lord and the confusion sown by Babylon's commingling. This is God's answer to Judaism, Islam, Christianity, and socialist secular humanism. Zerubbabel. Zera is seed. Babel is with the Lord. It is to say, not by might, not by ability, not by wealth, not by physical strength or one's capabilities, not by armies or troops, not with religion or politics, and not with force or authority, but in actuality, with my spirit, declares Yahweh. Oh, okay. So the answer isn't going to come through a religious institution. The answer is not going to come through a national politic. It's not going to happen at the UN conference on climate change. It isn't going to happen in another $1 trillion spending bill from the administration and Congress. It's not going to come from the most powerful army to ever exist in Navy and Air Force. This isn't going to come by might. It's not going to come from a Kyle Rittenhouse that carries an assault rifle. In fact, the individuals delivering the word of God to accuse the influence of Babylon, they're not going to do it with might or with wealth. They're not going to do it with force. They're not going to do it with any authority figure. No. The word that's going to devastate Babylon's influence is going to be spoken having been inspired by Yahweh's Spirit. We know that Eliyah was inspired by Yahweh's Spirit. Most brilliant oratory, funny, direct, biting, perfect, relevant. We know that. And the sucker, he's got the seven spirits of Yah working for him. And his whole focus is on the word of Yahweh. So he says, hey, I don't understand. The two olive trees are focused on the menorah. And so the messenger answered, okay, let me explain it to you. It ain't hard. This is the word of Yahweh to the nauseating seed of the Lord and the confusion sown by Babylon's commingling. It is to say, not by might, not by ability, not by wealth, not by force, not by some human authority, but in actuality, with my spirit, declares Yahweh, the vast array of spiritual messengers. Up to this point of the messenger's question, Zechariah had been shown a menorah, two olive trees, both of which he would have understood, including the connections between them. His interjection of the head wrap into the previous vision confirms that he knew his Torah. We're dealing with a well-read and bright man who was likely chosen because he was a quick study. Moreover, he would have had access to all of the prophets up to and possibly even including some of Malachi. One of the oldest scrolls found at Qumran, dating to the late 2nd century BCE, includes all of the minor prophets, with Zechariah's revelations positioned after Malachi's at the end of the scroll. Therefore, since he would have been intimately familiar with the design and the message of the menorah, and he would have understood its association with the olive, his question would not have been, what are these, but instead, why are these being presented to me? In Malachi's revelation, only one witness is listed, the other being sent to awaken Israelites from their slumber, just as Zechariah had been roused from his sleep. So, with that in mind, and considering Zechariah's inherent aptitude, he was asking, why are these here? He was wondering, why are there two olive trees witnessing on either side of the menorah? Now, before we reconsider the Malach's answer, remember, this is the man who interjected himself into the previous episode, telling the Malach to include the head wrap. I know the Torah too, but I didn't make that connection until after the Spirit pointed me to Kara for the answer. For Zechariah to have not only deduced this in the moment, which means he actually understood the content of the vision, but to have been so confident in his assessment that he would complete the scene while in Yahweh's presence, says that our prophet is much smarter than me and probably you and me combined.
Indeed.
I'm going to tell you, Kirk, if you and I are witnessing that episode in front of, take place in front of Yahweh, neither you or I are going to make a contribution. That's not going to happen.
No, no.
No, I mean, not one chance in a billion. I don't know if it's I don't think it's stage fright. I just think we'd just be overwhelmed. Yeah, too overwhelmed.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah.
You know, wow is not a cogent answer. And that's probably the best either one of us would mutter, and even that quietly so as not to draw attention to ourselves. Okay. So Zachariah's got it all over us. Fair enough to say?
Fair enough.
Okay. Based upon his calling, his intellect, and his desire to follow Yahweh's words to their intended conclusion, Zachariah would have been familiar with Yahshua's prophetic presentation of the Choder stem, with the entire chapter focused on him and the role he would eventually play. The prophet would have understood that Yahweh intended to enlighten and empower, equip and embolden the Choder with his spirit so that he could compose the Ness sign that God would raise on behalf of his people. Therefore, he would have surmised that it would not be by might, it would not be by ability or wealth, nor through armies, religion, or politics, and especially not through status or some personal qualifications, that the Choder would bring new life to an old and abandoned olive tree, but instead with my spirit. And it's really important. You and I kidded about this at the beginning of the show.
Mm-hmm.
The appointment to the role of Choder and Nacker is nothing that anyone can brag about. It's like standing on top of a stepladder. It's like winning a contest when there is no other contestant.
It's
getting first prize when you're the only one in the race. Okay?
Racing. Yeah.
There were no other choices. So, and to make it work, God had to lavish all seven spirits, everything he had in his toolbox.
Both barrels.
Okay, so it's the coolest job in the history of jobs. Well, no, it's the coolest job since Malachi and Zachariah. It's the coolest job since them, but hey, you know, it's an unnamed role, and it was awarded by default. That being so, why was the Malach being so snippy with him? Why do we read, "And the heavenly representative who had spoken with me answered and said to me, why do you not know Yada or understand what do these represent?" Now, I'm telling you that I'm not expecting the Malach to be sarcastic. I don't mind being put down by Yahweh and said, "Hey, pal, it wasn't because you had anything going for you. You were just the only option.
I looked around, you were it.
I looked around, you were it." So the very fact that you were willing to do this, okay, that was good enough. I could work with the rest of it. But Zachariah who is a prophet of Yahweh, is being admonished, really,
mm-hmm.
by a Malach. This is entirely different than what, you know, if you look at Job's 91st Mizmor Psalm. They're Malach aplenty assigned to everyone who is engaged conveying Yahweh's message. Yeah, they're there to help you. I'm not expecting the Malach to say, "Hey, stupid, come on, get with the program. What's wrong with you?"
What?
You know, because I'd come back and say, "Well, if you're so damn smart, why don't you do it?" You know. I'm going to go take a swim. See you later. Take a walk on the beach. You do it. Well, I tell you what, my tush hurts. I've been in this chair a long time.
Yeah.
The answer was provided by Dode. So, And the heavenly representative spoke with me, answered, and said to me, why don't you know, yada, or understand what these represent? The answer was provided by Dode. Yep, in the 14th Mizmor. He identified the Choter as yada. Do you know that?
Yes.
It is only other time that the Choter is mentioned. And so the spiritual messenger, already duly impressed by Zechariah's previous session with Yahweh, expected a similar response, knowing that Dode had written the following. The wise, the thinking and prudent, the most skillful and capable, properly instructed and learned woman builds up her home and family, while the foolish tears it down with her own hands. The wisest of feminine individuals, by the way, is the set-apart spirit.
Yes.
Although I have been blessed to have an exceedingly wise, thinking, and prudent woman building up my home and family.
Mm-hmm.
While the foolish tears it down with her own hands. He who walks with integrity in what he knows to be right respects and reveres Yahweh. One of the reasons, by the way, that there aren't any competitors, even today, 20 years after the Yahweh made his choice,
it was begun. Mm-hmm.
Is you know that there aren't other contenders, is there's no one else writing about Yahweh. And central to the Nesh, central to the Nacker, according to God, is a reverence and respect for Yahweh's name, making Yahweh's name known. No one else is doing that. And it's central to the mission. So, he who walks with integrity, he knows what's right. And he respects and reveres, The devious who are going the wrong way along the errant path disregards and despises him.
Yeah, that's the truth.
I would ask those who think that the rabbis are so G-D smart to find Yahweh's name anywhere in their Babylonian Talmud. By the way, the seed of Babylon, you may want to open the cover of the Babylonian Talmud to find it.
Mm-hmm.
What were the pronouncements of the stupidly stubborn citizenry and corrupt leaders? Over the pronouncements of the stupidly stubborn citizenry and the corrupt leaders, the simpletons, who as a nation of idiots fail to comprehend, of the ignorant and irrational government systems perverting and mocking the truth by promoting deceptions, of the argumentative and the licentious leaders, of an unthinking community who are adverse to understanding, a Choter, a stem off the main branch, who is an observant individual willing to listen and committed to thinking while treasuring the things which are valued, the Choter, will be lifted up to oppose and to agitate. The Awa will triumphantly rise up and grow to become an excellent counterbalance and an effective influence, roaring on behalf of the Almighty. And so the language of the one who learns, who comes to understand and then teaches, will focus on what he observes. With no herds to graze or beasts of burden, the one responsible for their feeding and care has empty fields. And yet a productive and abundant harvest is derived by the vigor and effort of the bold, who are observant and responsive. A trustworthy and reliable, enduring witness does not intentionally or consistently communicate that which is false. And yet a false and misleading witness pours out a torrent of lies and delusions. A scoffer intermittently seeks expertise and erudition, but there is none. Understanding based upon knowledge is swift and easy for the one who makes the proper connections. You should choose to walk away from the presence of an ignorant and irrational individual, because otherwise you will not come to know or appreciate Yada's understanding of the language or information and insights deduced from these words. The capacity to understand for the prudent and discerning comes by way of him making intelligent connections. However, the foolishness of the corrupt leadership deceives and misleads the irrational and the ignorant. Beguiled by corrupt leadership, those incapable of thinking for themselves mock, showing no respect for the atoning sacrifice. Alternatively, those who are right, on the level and straightforward, observe the connections between these things and come to understand the choices which lead to being approved and accepted. The locus of a person's thoughts and emotions knows, Yada, his own soul's mental anguish and hostility. And even if he experiences genuine jubilation as a result of overcoming adversity, no one benefits from that which is unacceptable, inappropriate, and illegitimate. The house of the revolting and the religious will be decimated and destroyed. The shining shelter and radiant household of those who are right will flourish and thrive. There is a way which appears right to humankind, but ends in the way of death. Mashal, Proverbs 14:12. Zachariah was much better informed and smarter than me, so the Malach was holding him to a high standard with his response. Since Yahweh had already introduced the Choder, explained his role, shared his name through Yashayah and Dod, the spiritual messenger thought that he would have realized that. While the first witness was Eliyah, the Choder, Yada, was represented by the olive tree on the sunset side of the menorah. This is Yahweh's style. The Malach representing him answered Zachariah indirectly, providing him with the information that he would use to make the necessary connections to understand. And with this in mind, let's re-examine Zechariah 4:4-6.
Okay.
So then I responded by saying to the spiritual messenger who had spoken to me, "What are these here, sir?" And the heavenly messenger who had spoken with me answered, and he said to me, "Why do you not know, Yada, or understand what these represent?" Said I do not, sir. Then he answered, and he said to me, "This is the word of Yahweh to Zerubbabel, the nauseating and scorched seed of the Lord, and the confusion sown by Babylon's commingling. It is to say, not by might, ability, or wealth, and not by the force or by some authority, but in actuality with my spirit, declares Yahweh of the vast array of spiritual messengers." Now, this is to say that the last two messengers represented by the early and late olive trees would speak the word of Yahweh, which was represented by his menorah's illumination against Zerubbabel, the nauseating seed of the Lord, and the confusions sown by Babylon's confusing commingling. The witnesses will be speaking out against that which is sown and scattered by being with Bel, the Lord, and Satan's association with the confounding nature of Babylon. Religion is the product of intermixing and commingling truth and lies to more effectively deceive. It's how Satan first beguiled Yahweh in the garden. It has remained his strategy ever since, which explains why the Talmud, Zohar, New Testament, and Quran contain so many misappropriated and misquoted statements from Yahweh's Torah and Nabi. Why, Zerubbabel is a name based upon the man's history. It speaks of the seed of Babylon. Like everything else associated with Satan in Zerubbabel, there is a commingling of good and bad. On the one hand, the word represents that which has been Zara, sown and scattered by Bel, the Lord, out of Babel, Babylon. And indeed, Yahweh will deploy two witnesses to call his people out of Babylon. But speaking of coming out of Babylon, the man named Zerubbabel came out of Babylon in one way, but not in another. He was appointed by Cyrus, the king of Babylon, to oversee Yehudah, Judea, upon the people's return from captivity. So while he walked out of Babylon, he carried its influence with him. With only one exception, he is always mentioned in the entourage of Yahusha, the high priest, whom Yahweh called perverted. In Ezra 3:2 through 3:8, we find Zerubbabel's name listed alongside Yahusha ben Yehosadak in concert with their journey out of Babylon, whereupon they commenced in rebuilding the temple. His name is mentioned in Ezra 5:2 in the same context. And Nehemiah 12:1, we find a similar reference indicating nothing more than that he was among those who had come from Babylon, including Yahusha. And Haggai, it gets a bit more interesting because in 1:1, Zerubbabel is introduced as the governor of Yehudah, which is to say that he had been appointed by King Cyrus of Babylon. Then it is Yahusha ben Yehosadak, the high priest in the previous revelation, who announces that Yahweh has decided that the time has come for the house of Yahweh to be rebuilt. Two, the first of two really positive accolades follow, wherein the same assemblage of fellows, along with the entire remnant of the people, listen to the voice of Yahweh as conveyed through the words of Haggai, the prophet. We learn that Yahweh stirred up a spirit of Zerubbabel, governor of Yehudah, and the spirit of Yahusha, the high priest, and then the spirit of all of the remnant of the people, and they came and worked on the house of Yahweh. Haggai 1:12-14. Considering Yahweh's negative assessment of these guys in the previous prophecy, he was using them much like he had used Cyrus. There is a curt genealogical reference in 1 Chronicles 3, leaving only one final mention in the short two-page declaration of Haggai regarding the man born and bred in Babylon. His final line reads, "Say to Zerubbabel, the governor administering the district for the king of Yehudah, saying, I will shake up the heavens and the earth. I will overthrow the throne of the kingdoms of the monarchical governments. I will decimate the militaries of the governments of the Gentile nations. I will destroy the mobilized weapons of war and those who drive them. I will send their airplanes crashing down with their pilots abandoning ship, everyone falling by the dagger and sword of his brother and countrymen. On that day, declares Yahweh of hosts, I will grasp hold of you, Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, which means I question God, who has served my interest, declares Yahweh, and I will cause you to be like a signet, an implement to make an impression, a seal and contrivance denoting an official designation. Because of you, I have made this decision, as it will be the best option, declares Yahweh of the spiritual messengers. The most positive spin that can be placed upon this is that Zerubbabel was similar to the king who had sent him. In Yeshaya 45, God says, of the arrogance and the murdering pagan patriarch monarch, that thus says Yahweh to his anointed, to Cyrus, for the sake of my associate, Jacob, and Yisrael, my chosen, I call you by your name. I name you, though you do not know me. They were tools. Tools to be used on behalf of Yisrael. But we will not see either of these Babylonians in Shamaim. Therefore, just as Yahweh denounced Yosha and his entourage, which would have included Zerubbabel, and has concluded his assessment of him by suggesting that he is the very insignia of Babylon, which has necessitated the demise of the modern incarnations of the Babylonian influence, we are wise to see Zerubbabel as the seed of Babylon. As a talented debater and orator, as was Elia, I suspect that even the prophet will be pleased to know that his witness will be enlightened and empowered by the Spirit. He went after Baal, the Lord, previously, and made mincemeat of Satan and his prophets. But a lot has transpired in the ensuing millennia, and the forces of evil have honed and diversified their game. Yahweh used an ordinary man coupled with a strong and forceful hand to withdraw his people from Mitzrayim. But his mission, this mission, is very different. Babylon isn't so much a place of slavery, but instead a host of debilitating institutions and crippling beliefs. The approach to the end, while plagued by man, will be framed in the words of God, spoken by the two individuals alongside a menorah. Then when the shouting is over, just as we read in the 14th Mashal, the foolish will die so that those who are right may live. Now, speaking to those who respect the might of nations and their militaries over the Spirit of God, authority figures over inspiration, the spiritual messenger, the Malach, asks, what do you think you are? A great and prominent figure? Before the presence of Zerubbabel, the confusing seed sown by Babylon, there will be a leveling out of those who are no longer upright. Then he will remove the capstone amid the deceitful and destructive shouts. Be kind and merciful towards it. Now, whether it is political, religious, or geographic Babylon, there is a Capitol Hill in America, the Vatican above all in Rome, and claims to the Temple Mount among Muslims. They all believe that they hold the high ground and that their claims are lofty and important. Yeah, not so much in God's eyes, because he's going to level them. It is what happens when a person who is standing against him dissolves, turning to goo. Those who have questioned what is agreeable and straightforward will be flatlined, reduced in dimensions such that they only exist in time. The capstone of Christianity is the New Testament. The cornerstone of Judaism is the Babylonian Talmud. For Americans, it is their claims of superiority and manifest destiny, the right to meddle in everyone else's lives. For Muslims, it is Allahu Akbar, the absurd notion that Allah is greater, bigger, older, more capable than Yahweh, although Allahu Akbar really means Allah is a mouse. God does have a sense of humor. Confronting
indeed.
Them with the truth, the witnesses will be reduced to rubble. To consume the fruit of Babylon is to be confused, the result of intermixing the Lord's seeds with those shared by Yahweh. The presence of Babel, men and women, are misled. To be Babel with the Lord is to be estranged from Yah. Our only hope is to come out of her before it is too late. Before this leveling out is spoken of in the prophets. A voice calls out, remember, to make straightforward mm-hmm. the approach to Yahweh. The monoliths which have emerged out of Babylon are going to be toppled. With the capstone removed, the edifice is going to fall. But even then, those who prefer the lies to the truth, religion over relationship with God, will cry even to their last breath. Yeah, there's going to be tashu'ah, deceitful and destructive shouts which are devastatingly ruinous, worthless and falsified clamoring. Be kind and merciful towards it. Out of their minds, the faithful will shout, Chin Chin La Hu, show some favoritism and respect, considering her popularity, her overall acceptance, and her beauty. Political correctness run amok. The masses will not like the hateful rhetoric brought to bear against Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and especially progressive multiculturalism. And yet that's going to be the message of the two witnesses. Well, I've got to tell you, I loved every word spoken by Elia. The world will react hatefully to his style. Yada will be similarly received. In the battle between Yah and the Lord, Satan, grace will not prevail. The witness's message will be inspired by the menorah to bring down the lofty edifice of Babylon. And yet, even as the exemplar of man's worst behavior and the preeminent beast, some good came out of Babylon. Cyrus released God's people, and Zerubbabel mm-hmm. oversaw the construction of the house of Yah. Zechariah 4:9. Then the word of Yahweh came to exist inside me, saying, the actions of Zerubbabel, the seed of Babylon, established a foundation for the house, but under his influence, it would come to a violent end, as he was greedy for an unjust gain. And therefore, you will know that Yahweh of the spiritual messengers has sent me to you. Because why deride and show contempt for this insignificant day when you can delight in seeing the plumb line, and the hand of Zerubbabel. These seven eyes of Yahweh, they roam throughout the entire land. All right, so Zechariah was a prophet, not a reporter. So announcing the completion of the second temple was hardly news, and certainly not going to validate his credentials. But what was prophetic, especially with the copy of this prophecy dating to the second century BCE, is that in the first century CE, the house of Yahweh would come to a violent end as a result of those greedy for an unjust gain. It would be broken apart and torn down, ceasing to exist. The prophecy fulfilled. What Yahweh appears to be saying is that we should not sweat the fact that Zerubbabel and his priests, along with their Babylonian amalgamation of religion and politics, played a role in rebuilding the temple. The temple the Babylonians had torn down. Further, what they were building would be misused by Yehudim and then ripped apart by Rome, the seat of Babylon. They took its riches to fund the construction of their abhorrent Colosseum. It was an insignificant act during the time the beast of Babylon was evolving through Persia to Greece, to Rome, and then to Roman Catholicism. Therefore, we should see the humor, or at least the irony, in the seed of Babylon holding the plumb line. The seven eyes of Yahweh roaming the land seems to attest to this. Yahweh was aware of what was going to happen, so he watched as the world evolved into the precipice of self-annihilation. As for Zechariah, he was still stuck on finding an answer to his initial question as to why these two olive trees were there. Yep. It was then that I interjected and asked of him, who are these olive trees on the right and on the left of the menorah? Who is on the right and who is on the left? And then I made a second request, and I asked of him, who are these two twigs, the sprigs, speaking of smaller stems off the main branch of the olive trees, which are in reach of the two golden pipes, pouring forth from out of them that which is golden, brilliant and shimmering, valuable and desirable. Zechariah 4:12. Well, first of all, it appears that we were correct. Zechariah understood the symbolism of the menorah and appreciated the witness of the olive trees. He just wanted to know why there were two of them, and since there were two, he wanted to identify them. In his final request, Zechariah offers some additional insights. The olives are more akin to twigs, smaller stems off the main branch, and that is to say they were chodoresque. Further, they were near the source of the olive oil, within reach of the two golden conduits, one to Pesach Matzen Bakurim, the other to Teruah Kippurim and Sukkah. As a result, that which was ha-zahab, brilliant and valuable, would flow out of them. This is to say that the Spirit would inspire them to speak the word of Yahweh with her authority. And so he replied to me by asking, even now, do you not know Yada and realize who these are? Again, I answered, no, sir. So he said, they are the two sons of the olive oil and thus the anointed ones, who stand present before Yahweh for everyone on earth. So he said, they are the two sons of the olive oil, and thus the anointed ones. The sons of the olive oil, that would be sons of the Spirit, born of the set-apart Spirit, who stand present before Yahweh for everyone on earth. They are the final two witnesses. This would make them Elyon Yada, children of the Spirit and beneficiaries of the anointed Masayach Dod. Present and standing before Yahweh, they serve as witnesses for everyone throughout the land. Well, this is the first time I've been able to explain Zechariah 3 or 4. I'm obviously a slow study. I have been acquainted with this message for some time. About 4 years ago now, I was sitting at my desk, maybe three. I guess about 3 years ago, I was sitting at my desk. I was completing a translation and preparing for one of these programs, a Shabbat Torah study, on right here, Yada Yada Radio. My fiance at the time, my wife today, asked, so what's going to happen to Asher? Asher is right here on my left foot. I think it's asleep because she's got her entire body weight laying on top of it. And she says, so what's going to happen to Asher? It's our Labrador, after the Teruah harvest. So I asked Yah, I said, hey, Yah, can we bring her with us? To which he said, where do you think you're going? Why do you think I openly named one of the two witnesses and not the other? All right, Kirk. So you said you did a little artistry with some of these words. I want to tell you that with all the enthusiasm that I could muster, I went through that because if I don't present it that way, I just break down in tears embarrassed.
Yeah, let me say this. I don't want to distract from this presentation because I think it's wonderful. I mean, I enjoyed it as much reading it, and I enjoyed it even more in your reading it tonight and following along with the insights and so forth and a few things that I kind of discovered. Let me do this rather than fill people up with minutiae that will be less effective because they should just dwell on this. I was studying, you know, we know the name Yada, we know what it is, Necker, Shoulder, et al. And as I was looking through the earlier words of this, I found some really interesting things that I thought, well, that has to be, it can't be anything else. That's got to be this Goy person. So, and it's a little bit heavy on detail. But let me write it all down precisely. I will send it to you in the meantime next week. Okay. If you think it has worthy, we will discuss it because it is pretty cool, at least it is to me, but I get off on these things, so that's why.
Mm-hmm.
But let me do it that way because I really don't want to disturb this. They should mm-hmm. stop and just, if they're not reading along with it, they should just stop and play this over because this is a unique presentation of some wonderful stuff. And just
Zechariah was inspired to introduce us to the single most important day,
yes.
And Yahweh's eternal existence.
Mm-hmm.
Or Masseh is the most important day, and our human existence from our perspective, looking at Yah and coming to Yah, it's the Chag Masseh, Pesach Batzer Bekorim.
Mm-hmm.
Matzah is not a lot of fun for God. Nor was
Pesach. No, it's horrible.
So,
no.
So that's not the highlight of his existence. Let me share that with you. The highlight
of God's
existence is the ultimate reconciliation, the coming together, the return of the chosen people. The ultimate celebration is Yom Kippurim. And Yahweh, to have Yom Kippurim be an important date, for it to live up to Yahweh's expectation, what is the one thing that has to occur? What is the one thing that is missing from Yom Kippurim being the day that Yahweh enjoys more than any other day in his entire eternal existence? The return of his people.
Oh, yeah.
And how do his people return if there aren't witnesses pointing them in the right direction? Because I'm here to tell you, the Torah has been with us for 3,400 years. The most recent of the prophets, this one, for example, has been with us for 2,500 years. The information has been there. It's been written down. It's been available. It was given to God's people in their language, given to them in their language. It's been there for 2,500 to 3,400 years, and they're no closer today to celebrating the Day of Reconciliations than they were 3,450 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So something has to change. And how is God going to get his people's attention so that they pay attention to and for the first time ever understand his message and respond appropriately to it if he doesn't have a witness?
Mm-hmm.
That
he's,
is why
he's got to
these
him, yeah.
two witnesses were presented right here at the beginning of Yahweh's prophetic testimony regarding the fulfillment of Yom Kippurim, because there is no celebration of Yom Kippurim without the difference that the witnesses make.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you, it's well said, it's well written, it's worth reading over and over and over again. I hope I can add some stuff to it next week. I think I can. I saw a program that covered the oldest languages and where they came from, and by gosh, before they got through with it, they found something that has the Hebrew letters, pictographs on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was and they can just know from that stage where mankind, these people, Hebrews, I'm sure they were, they call them Canaanites, but they were Hebrews,
mm-hmm.
could took the pictographs more than just a concept symbol to a sound and turn it into a fruitful language, unbelievable. And why they walked away from the pictographs, I'll never know. This has to be because it'd be too simple, I guess, then. They couldn't twist it. The religious people couldn't twist it. But in there, in this passage, there was a whole bunch of stuff that points to the Choder, to the Nakri. And I just thought I'd add it, so I'm going to write it to you. And
okay.
Tell me what you think, and
now,
we'll present it.
For those who are listening here, mm-hmm. because you're still on the phone, I see that there's a lot of listeners. The switchboard is still full of listeners who are still hearing us, beyond the fact that 99% of the listenership for this program is through the archives, which are presented on Yahweh Barret. They're presented on the linked from the yadaya.com site, yada, Y-A-D-A, Y-A-H, yadaya, and yadayahweh.com sites. But all of the supporting sites, including Shamar Torah and David's God, where he has every passage presented in its entirety that we have translated, and Yahweh Barret, these are all sites that can post what you have written. Kirk is a very analog guy. I'm an analog guy in a digital world where we're throwbacks to a different age. Mm-hmm. Kirk's favorite way of communicating is to write it on lined paper, ruled paper,
legal
with
pad.
His artist's hand of the original characters, and then to draw pictures that help us understand. In other words, he's communicating exactly as the language was designed. Those as attachments can be presented on those sites. Those sites are linked directly from the yadaya.com site. And so for those who want to prepare prior to next week's program, as Kirk and I are going to do by reading what he has found, I'm certain that our friends will post it there and we'll have the chance to consider it before the program. And there is something that you said that is, I have admitted here recently, that is a big difference from the, I've been doing this program now for, I guess, for 15 years probably. And in the last 6 months to a year, there has been a decided difference from the way I used to do the program. I used to only read the citations from the Torah and prophets and never read any of my commentary. And I would always extemporaneously speak to the prophetic text.
The verses you were doing.
And, here at this program, I would say probably a third of what I communicated was extemporaneous, including all the review of the news. But about a third of what I talked about, even in this review of the text of Zechariah 4, including my review of Zechariah 3 and Kara, was extemporaneous or impromptu. And the reason that I've always preferred that is that there's a sincerity that comes from knowing the material and being comfortable with it to the extent that it just flows out of you. And so I thought that style was additive to the text so that someone who had read the books would get even more out of the programs because we looked at each of Yahweh's prophetic statements from fresh eyes and a new perspective with the audio program.
Speaking right from the heart.
That changed about a year ago. As you said, I read my commentary now. I know probably 10 times more than I knew a year ago, which is 10 times more than I knew 2 years ago, and 10 times, 10 times, 10 times more than 3 years ago. This is a pretty steep learning curve in this when it comes to Yahweh's Witness. So I'm much more comfortable talking extemporaneously than I was previously. But there's something that happened, and I don't know what the trigger was, but there's something that happened during the rewrite of these books. And, we're well past now 20 of the volumes that have been rewritten. Something happened where the way that the commentary regarding the insights that could be derived from Yahweh's translations took on a different tenor. When it came to being anti-religious and political, it was much more biting, much more Elia-like. When it came to the insights, they were much more profound. And so the commentary, as it was placed in writing on this, during this last year and a half, as we've been retranslating and rewriting everything, has a very different tenor to it, I guess is the best term, a resonance to it. And I'm convinced that if I don't share it with you as it was conveyed to me as I was writing it, that rather than providing something that you could just read, I think I would be cheating the listener. I think now that it's better to hear it and to be able to read it and have it reinforced this way, because there's just so much to it. It's so rich. It is There's so many intertwined strings in this fabric, threads to this fabric. And it's so relevant for Yahweh's people that this is a different style to this program. And, I'm not a listener to the program, but as you, like a participant, so I don't know how that might sound
to
our listeners, but it is, as the Spirit is leading, says it's as it should be. Yahweh has a very, very strong preference for the written word, overwhelmingly so. And yet Yahweh constantly tells us, in addition to shamar, to observe, which is to read the written word, that we should listen to him. And we listen to him by reciting those words. And so it is this permanence of the written word, this ability to do your own investigation and verification and analysis at your own pace and depth, that is only available in the written word, that is not available in the spoken word, that God cherishes, but that he also wants us to mouth the words, to hear them, to listen to them. And the enthusiasm and passion that can be derived from them. And so this style of depending upon and cherishing the written word and then conveying it so that we can hear it, that's Yahweh's style. And the more that we do this, Kirk, the more our style and our perspective mirrors his. We become more like him the more time we spend with him, which is as it should be. And so that is the reason for this style. Go ahead.
Yeah, there was one little taste of the first one that it hit me. I think I understand the letters better than I ever have before, in the sense of especially in the context of what's being written, and I can see it. But there's a little word where we started in Zechariah 4:1, which is Gala. And Gala is written as a gimel and a lamb and a hay. But the gimel is always considered, most of the time, would be a bad word, because a word that
negative
is going in the wrong direction. Negative implication,
right.
Yes. So I'm looking at that and I'm saying, this is really important. Why is the word chosen Gala? And it means to uncover or to expose. And that's normal. You'll find that everywhere. But then I thought, well, heck, Kirk, you dummy. It's a goy. And what's the lamb do? It's leading you. Where is it leading you? It's to revere Yah. That's an upright. So it's a lamb hay. And in the context of who we're going to be talking about throughout this whole thing, he's asking Zechariah, who is this guy? I mean, what is it? He's trying to tell him who Yah is. He's trying to say, look, think. And it's all in little words that you wouldn't even think you would find it there.
And as you pointed out, Gala is the first word that you went to. If you recall, at the beginning of this program, I said the central word here that unravels all of this for us is Gala. Until you understand Gala, you're trying to figure out what a bowl is doing floating above the menorah, and now you've got a symbol that makes no sense. You know, I read 20 different analyses of what the crazy bowl represents. And I want to tell you, stupid is as stupid does. And then it said, ay, 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 there is no bowl. Yeah. Gala means to reveal, to expose, to make known. And then once you're there, now what are you making known? You're making known the menorah and the two olive trees, which then Yahweh explains, which are the words of Yahweh against the confusing influence of Babylon, that he is inspiring through his spirit. And as you have just pointed out, and I missed, that there's more to Gala than what is we conveyed and revealed. Gala is the Gimel. It's the Goyim. It's the foot going in the wrong direction. Typically, right? The foot going against the flow, because Hebrew reads from right to left. Gimel's going from left to right.
But if you look at it,
you think of
Yahweh's.
Yeah, think about the Israelites. They're all going from left to right, and they're all going away from God. And so here's this guy. He's walking against them, confronting them. Gala, to make a revelation. And what are the other two letters? A Lamed. Shepherd's staff. He's trying to guide these wayward sheep back into the fold.
Return. Shub.
And who is he speaking
to? Go to the hay.
The hay, the observant individual who's looking up, reaching up to God.
To in awe to Yahweh, which is,
But he is walking towards them with the shaft of the shepherd and walking to those people. So there we are.
It's a lot of stuff there. I mean, I think that's why we found the letters.
Yes.
It's just, wow. Just reiterates everything we said. It's not as...
Right. Listen, I think it's important to communicate this and to reinforce it. It is not an honor. It is not a trophy. It is not... There's no remuneration. There's no prize. There's no... There's no anything that goes along with the job of Choder, Knacker, other than it's really fun and cool to work with Yahweh. It really is. I mean, it's the best job in the universe to be able to do that. You know, unfortunately, some of the joy is a little different because to see this prophetically presented, now there's a sense of responsibility. And so, I tend to see to spend a little too much time in the chair trying to write this. But that aside, the thing that changed so profoundly is that for God to mention how he was going to reconcile his relationship with the people and how he was finally going to get their attention and to see it all over, beginning in the Torah, running through the prophets with entire chapters, multiple chapters about this individual and Yeshaya. The centerpiece of two of the most inspiring speeches that ever made. Yahweh is trying to say, pay attention. I'm doing this for you. He's a tool that I'm using. I'm doing this for you so that you come home. Capitalize on what God's doing. Listen. So there's only one reason that he is prophetically making these announcements, particularly to the remnant in the last days. You've got a lot of people lying to you. You've got a lot of people that are taking you in the wrong direction. God chose somebody to reveal the truth to you, and he wants you to listen. And that's the reason he's saying all of this. And ultimately, there are those two witnesses. They're on either side of the menorah. They're speaking the word of God against Babel. By the way, think about unglamorous jobs. Can you imagine what that's going to be like?
It's hard to imagine.
Just everybody against you. I mean, it'll be fun to listen to Elia rip him to shreds. That'll be worth a giggle. But
I'm sure that old guy can put his two or three cents in there, and cause he knows the world that is today. Yes, Zachariah cannot know that.
No, he's not. Zechariah is not prepared. Yakuya is a quick study. Elia is a quick study. Elia is capable of debating and effectively destroying the credibility of anyone who is misled and full of themselves. Dude's got it. He has the gift. But Iyaz's preference is to deploy implements that are already aware of what's wrong. Because his preference is to emphasize what's right, because there's so much to learn about what's right that if you already know and you already agree with him on what's wrong, that's kind of his preference. And so, yeah, I don't see Elia. Well, clearly, Elia is only one of the two olives. So, he's going to have a bud that's going to be a little more up to speed with where the world has gone. And you know, we're keep in mind too, we're not only speaking to Israelites. God made it really clear that there's one Torah for all, there's one covenant for all, and in his speech in Devarim, Moshe said, you know, I'm not just cutting this covenant with Israel. I'm cutting it for all the foreigners who are here that have decided that they want to camp out with us.
Yeah,
it's for all of too.
Yeah, if you want to walk this path, you're in.
Yeah, and if you listen to Solomon's speech, it very clearly says that while his priority is going to be Israel, simultaneously he's going to be speaking to and resonating with other goyim. So, you know, in the end, it's going to be plenty of both. So you do have Elia to speak effectively to the people. And I'm writing a lot about Judaism these days, but I would really rather have Elia.
You take him on.
Take him on. You know, the one of the things is just so hilarious to me. Is that the whole nature of corruption of religion is you counterfeit something that is true. So the rabbinical seder, the Passover dinner, while the plate has become totally Keynesian, they're making an offering that God rejected on their plate. They've got all manner of veggies and really no lamb. The rabbis set a place, glass of wine, a little, they even put a zeroa on the plate.
Wow.
For Elia. And guess what day that Elia is returning? Passover.
Right. Yeah.
So he actually is coming back on Passover.
I'm here. Did you set my table?
I'm here.
Let's talk about it.
Oh, by the way.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
You got some explaining to do because, I was not very happy with you. But he is coming back on Passover. One of the nice things about that is that if indeed the final harvest, Teruah harvest, if it is on Teruah in 2029, then we would have 6 months of away time prior to having to return. So that part's pretty appealing. A little vacation. May go to Alpha Centauri. Who knows? A little vacation. Go visit a nebula or two. might even play a round of golf.
Hey, never know.
Never been able to play Cypress Hill or the Cypress Point, I should say, or Augusta National, although I'm not quite as crazy about playing Augusta National as I am a number of other courses. But I don't know why I got into that. But anyway, it sounds appealing to have a little vacation. Have a little golf, have a little vacation, be able to go take a walk on the beach with the dog. Asher, are you going to come with me? Asher has finally woke up from her nap. The show starts later. It's way past Asher's bedtime.
Yeah.
All right,
my friend. Sorry, Asher.
Sorry to get the silliness of playing golf that is irresponsible. What the heck? It is late. It is late here, and I'm an older guy. It's past my bedtime.
Yeah.
Good night. May y'all bless.
Good night.
Look forward to being with you all next week. If we're going to be retired for making silly comments and the like, so be it. Good luck finding another one, huh?
Yeah. You have a little leverage.
The will to do it is ought to be.
Yeah, I'm still willing.
Still willing. I'm looking behind me.
But he shows up.
Right. There's 20 volumes here that says willing. Don't know how able, but there's 20 volumes. It's over 2 feet just at the spines. That suggests willing. God likes willing.
Yes.
Willing goes a long way.
Okay.
Yep. Available and willing.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, have fun.
Happy
paradise.
Shabbat. Yep. Look forward to your graphic analysis.
I'll be working tomorrow and put it all together.
Was a really, really good insight with galah. That's such a perfect word because it's the word that leads to the understanding of this whole thing. It's the word that takes away the confusion and takes us to understanding.
It ain't a bowl.
All right. Good night, my friend.
All right,
God bless.
Good night.
Bye.
Yes,
good night.
Sir. You too. Bye-bye.